and we choose the threshold and we retain only the singular values which are higher than this threshold. So effectively what it means is that we are saying that this signal of air quality indices, and we look at all these signals, they are not very high frequency signals. Things don't dramatically change. So it's like a low frequency signal, and by retaining only the small singular values, we are retaining the low frequency component. And we are saying that that captures most of the information in these vectors. That's the idea. So what you do is, okay, so you do this singular value decomposition, you only retain, you know, the top few singular values, and then you do the inversion, you get your mean, estimate of the mean, which is the function of the latent variables. Now you rescale back to your original whatever support was for y's. Once you have done that, then you obtain your beta hat by, you know, you can do standard regression techniques. So either you can do, you know, just least square, or you can do ridge regression or lasso regression, any of those standard machine learning techniques. You know, you pick up Python, you insert a function and it'll pop out the answer to you. So this step is very easy. So you do this, do that, you get the weights. Once you have the weights, then you can get the counterfactual. You have the air quality measurements of all the other cities. You have this M after the intervention. You have the weights. Then you say after the intervention, after the policy was changed, this is what the air quality would have looked like. And if it matches the actual, then you say the intervention had no effect. It's like a placebo. But if there's a difference, then you can say that, okay, this actually made a difference. So there are some theoretical results where we show that given some assumptions on rank, this thing converges, the error is bounded. I'm going to skip over the results. This is just to impress you that we have done some math behind it and it's not completely bogus. And here are the results. So there were studies done of Proposition 99 in California, which was studying the impact of a legislation which restricted the sale of tobacco to minors and others. And people wanted to estimate the impact of that legislation on the sale of tobacco in the future. You know, people are sort of getting away from smoking in general. So nobody knew that when sale of tobacco fell, was it because of the legislation or was it because of this society is moving away from smoking? And the study of this counterfactual actually showed that the legislation did have an effect. Another study was effect of terrorism in the standard of living in Basque County. Okay, this is a well-known study. And what we were able to do is, you know, we randomly removed measurements, we randomly added noise, and the synthetic control was working as well, the robust synthetic version was working as well as the synthetic control with full data. But when we tried to do synthetic control and we removed entries, it sort of collapsed. So this is showing, you know, where the counterfactual is deviating from the true. It shows that there is, you know, an impact of whatever intervention there was. And just to convince ourselves that this thing actually works, here are some studies of placebos. So we took the date where that tobacco sale restriction law was passed, and we looked at other states, not California. And we did the same thing of building the counterfactual predicting. And there you see that in all these other states, the counterfactual and the actual reality is matching very closely.
You could have done California, but earlier.
Yeah, we could have done that as well. So, yeah.
In the last time, what was the last
graph? This one? Yeah. So, in this, the synthetic Basque, we did no denoising. So, the denoising was done by retaining only the top few singular values. If you don't do that, then you know, the counterfactual sort of collapses. So it's no longer robust. So we're showing, you know, what that denoising or just retaining the top few singular values, what effect it has on the synthetic control. Yeah. I'll show. I mean, so you can see, you can construct the eigenvalues, you can plot them, and you'll see a sharp decay. So the rough rule of thumb is you try to retain 99% of the energy.
This theorem that you prove, you assume that the top row lies in the space of
smooth. So we assume that the function, that this latent variable function, is Lipschitz, and you know, the space is compact, and under some assumptions you can show that it's low rank.
No, you're trying to predict the top row with smoothened version of bottom rows.
No, the mean of the top row, yeah, with smoothened versions of the bottom rows, yeah.
Right. So you have to assume somehow that the combination of the bottom rows smoothened,
yeah,
contain the top row.
Yeah, yeah. So that comes from the low rank assumption, and the Lipschitz assumption to show that it'll actually, the error is bounded. Actually Lipschitz implies low rank, because if it's not Lipschitz, then you know, you'll have you can have sudden jumps, and sudden jumps implies that it's a high frequency signal, so it's not low rank. We can talk offline, but yeah.
So I'm trying to understand, if you take the top left side graph.
Yeah. Yes.
And the upper curve is a numerical prediction of what would have happened.
Without. Yeah.
But you have no validation of the correctness of that.
Yeah, so that's where this placebo study has come in.
Placebo merely tells you that you don't go completely crazy with your predictive scheme.
Yeah. On error bars on the counterfactual. So for that, I mean, let me come back to that. It has to do on the assumption of how much data you have pre-intervention, how close your approximation is going to be, and what is the rank of the basic system, the matrix. It depends on how many pre-intervention data points that you have. The more that you have, the better is the approximation, and the better is supposed to be the prediction. Now I'll come to sort of the fun part of the talk. Are there any questions about the basic mechanism of synthetic control or the robust version of it? Low rank matrix, but yeah. Yeah.
Is it not?
Yeah.
Statistical model, basically random matrix theory, is the one theory for stretch theory of the kind. And that matrix, random, you know, developing that matrix, and from that you have calculated.
Yeah.
This is the fixed aspect.
No, yeah. No arguments there. It's basically that, yeah. So, what you would do is,
suppose I give two cities before passing the field, I have given the time series data beforehand.
So you have the time series data of let's say Delhi.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you train that.
Normally we have taken the
but you train based on this time series, right? So this is part of why it works so well. The idea is that these things are correlated, and the other cities are giving you information about this signal. Alone, this signal doesn't carry all the information. It's a latent variable model in two dimensions. I'll also talk about something called the Stein's paradox, which comes in sports. Just we'll come back to this issue. But we have tested, you know, this works much better than RNN or LSTM based predictions. Okay, let's now look at cricket. So the setting in cricket is, let's say we have all the innings available. We were looking at one day 50 over games. It can apply to other settings as well. We have all the innings ball by ball data available. So the length or the number of columns is of this matrix is 300. 50 over 6 balls each, you have 300 columns. The number of rows is all the games that have happened historically. Metric, we are looking at runs. That's what we are trying to build a synthetic control for and estimate. The observations that we have are the runs on each ball and the wicket count for each ball. Now, we account for no balls and wides by, you know, spreading those runs in the ball previous to that. So, I mean, we take care of all those corner cases. So, you build this matrix of Y, and intervention time. Now, this is not really a true intervention in the sense that something changes. It's not like you pass the odd even rule or California passes this Prop 99. We just want to predict from some point. So, it's an arbitrary point, but again, like that intervention, it's some point B0. Some column value which is less than B. Inning of interest is the top row. Past innings are all the other rows, and we want to predict.
This is all cricket games ever played or played only between those two
people? That's that classifies as an excellent question, and I'll come back to that. This is Stein's paradox exactly. We'll come back to that. So what first what we did was we looked at this matrix of all the games. We had about 3000 one day internationals, 3000 by 300 matrix. We computed the singular values, and you know, the top 15% singular values are plotted here, and most of the energy is contained here. You can see, you know, there's a rapid decline in the singular value magnitude. What does this mean physically? It means physically that games or the run trajectories follow in sort of some predictable ways. So some of it is constrained just by the laws of the game. If you are on ball 24, then ball 25 can at most be ball 24 plus 6 or maybe plus 7 if it's a no ball, or worst case plus 9. Some of those trajectories are impossible just by the rules of the game. So your space automatically starts shrinking because of that. The other thing is, you know, every player, every match, you play according to the situation, and you don't do absurd things. You follow a predictable path. There are only limited things that you'll do, right? If you have been scoring at let's say 5 runs an over for 15 overs, you won't suddenly switch to scoring to 10 runs and over after that. And you're also not going to play out 5 maidens, typically, right? So the space of possibilities actually is small. So this says that there's memory in cricket. What you see happening today has probably happened before. A very similar innings has happened before. That's sort of the intuition of low rank of this matrix. Did that answer your question? Or?
No,
don't pay attention to the app.
That's not runs, so that's not anything.
No. Don't try to physically interpret the, just the number is not, the absolute value is not important. The relative value or where the energy is concentrated is important, and that shows you that it's really a low dimensional system. You good? So, okay. So now we actually, based on this theory, we have built a portal. You can go to cricket.mit.edu and you can actually run this portal live. Live in the sense that it won't do it for a game currently in progress. We don't have the capability to ingest that data. Maybe we'll get it soon. But you can go there. You can, you know, click on application. You can look at past games, you can choose team A, team B, date, pass a simple capture test, and then what you can do is you can look at how you predict, how you can do the prediction. So here, this is the World Cup quarter final between India and Australia in you know, the 2011 World Cup, and here we are predicting the score at the end of 35th over. So we are saying that it's going to end up somewhere here. Okay. The trajectory so far is the solid red line. The orange is our synthetic control, the mean trajectory that we have fitted based on this data. And then you can add the predicted trajectory and you can add the actual trajectory. And you see that our prediction is actually very accurate. This prediction was within one run of the final. So the total score will keep going until you lose 10 wickets or you finish 300 balls or 50 overs. But this is a very good question that you asked. It's very insightful that I've been talking about runs, but what about wickets? How do we predict outs? Right? So there is an additional metric available which we haven't spoken about. The data matrix that we looked at was simply the runs. But wickets are important, right? If at this 35th over India or Australia was 8 down and we were predicting 259 or 260, that would be completely absurd. But we haven't used the wickets so far. Right? So what do we do about the wickets? This is an additional metric. So we can do the same sort of synthetic control independently for wickets and predict the fall of wickets. But that also doesn't make sense. Why doesn't it make sense? No, it depends on how many runs you have scored, right? If at the 35th over you are 379 for 6, you know, you'll go crazy and that doesn't matter. But if your score is 120 for 6, then you'll be more careful with your wickets. So the wickets and runs, there is a correlation between them. There are different metrics, but there is a correlation. So what we did next was, you know, propose a generalization of this robust synthetic control into a multi-dimensional version. So how do we can do that when the wicket becomes a primary metric. So let me explain what this generalization is. So this is the recent work that we've done, which is multi-dimensional robust synthetic control. How do you utilize multiple types of behavior for finding similar, using very similar data? So what we had to do earlier, when we were doing this fit and projection, was when we were looking at the donor pool, we were doing a pre-filtering, which is like cheating. You can say it's cheating. what we were doing was we were looking at, let's say, at this intervention time, the number of wickets fallen was 5. We were only looking at innings which at this time had maybe 6 or 4 wickets fallen. We say that those were good donors to form the synthetic control, but that's kind of a heuristic and we wanted to be more rigorous about that. Yeah.
So how early can you do your intervention? I mean 35th over, by which time you kind of
I'll come to that. You can do the intervention here and predict up to here. Right. So how the farther out you go, the more noisier it is, like any other prediction system, whether you're using LSTMs or ARIMA models. So how do you combine different metrics? This was the question posed, and so we came up with this tensor formulation. Again, it's not important what the exact formulation is, but what we did was, I forgot to save a slide, but in the original mean matrix formulation, we had this matrix as a function of two latent variables. One of them sort of represented the time index, other represented the donor ID, the rows and columns. Now we have a tensor. So tensor is a generalization of, you can say, a matrix. Or each slice of a tensor is a matrix, and the third sort of order of this tensor represents the kind of metric we are looking at. So this W or omega, it could represent runs, or it could represent wickets. In other scenarios, it could be the other kinds of measurements that you do. I'll show an example of another scenario, but this is the tensor formulation that we have, and the latent variable model matrices in MRSC formulation, multidimensional RSC, look very similar to the previous case. What we do is, now originally we had only one kind of observation or matrix. Now what we do is we look at other kinds of observations and stack them horizontally one after the other. So imagine that this Y, up until here you have the run trajectory, then you have the wickets trajectory, but the metric of interest that you are trying to predict is still maybe runs. You are going to use the context of wickets, you are still trying to predict runs. So this is what the Y looks like, and M and E are similar. So again, you have multiple independent measurements. They are related because of the latent variables, and what you do is you just stack these independent measurements horizontally together, and then you go about and do the same thing. You again denoise it, you make it robust, and you do a regression. You can actually use nonlinear regression, you can do all sorts of things there is no restriction there, and all sort of convergence results that we had for unidimensional, they carry over for multidimensional, but the additional dimensions actually provide faster convergence. Every additional dimension that you have is additional data, and it lets you build this synthetic model faster. So with minimal data, you can build a better predictor. So as an example, we did this MRSC to some sales data from Walmart. This is a Kaggle competition where you have to predict the sales of different Walmart departments, clothing, electronics, and all that. They had this data for different stores, and we first did RSC for a particular department. Department IDs are given here. They could be clothing or whatever, I don't know. But for a particular store, we did RSC, robust synthetic control, unidimensional, and then the prediction actually it overfitted to that particular department's sales numbers, and the predictions were actually way off. The blue is the prediction and the gray is the actual sales. Then what we did next was we did MRSC. We looked at sales for other departments. Right? You have clothing, you have electronics, you have all sorts of departments. We built an MRSC and tried to predict clothing based on information that we were getting from other departments. Right? But when you imagine that, you know, a customer walks into a store, a lot of factors determine how many customers are coming there, the weather, it's a holiday and all that. So all those other metrics are related. Those latent variables are common. I mean, it, intuitively it does make sense. We also have a formal way of establishing which metrics can you add. Right? You, suppose you have a cricket score. You cannot randomly add basketball scores to that matrix and expect it to work. The way we test for it is you take one metric, look at the rank of that matrix, you add another metric and look at the rank of that matrix. If the rank increases, then we say, no, this is unrelated. But if the rank stays the same or reduces, then we know that information is being added to the system. So that's a falsifiability test that we can do. But this is how the MRSC extension works. Then RSC becomes a special case of MRSC, and you know the original synthetic control again becomes a very special case of RSC. So this sort of generalizes this whole theory. And it all started with cricket, so that's the good part. So what else can you do? So you know, earlier I showed you the prediction of 35 overs and it was bang on target. It was 260 was the prediction, 259 was what Australia got. But let's say we did the prediction at the end of the 30th over. What happened? Why is our prediction off? This is a test of a real cricket fan here. So between overs 30 and 35, Zahir Khan produced a magical spell and he got two crucial wickets. Those two crucial wickets changed the trajectory of that game from that point onwards. By the time we got to the 35th over, our system had accounted for those two wickets because the wicket, that additional dimension, those wickets had been accounted for, and then our prediction became accurate again. So another thing that you can do with this is you can automatically generate highlights of a game. You can look at historic games or just a game that is being played today, and you look at the evolution, and then you suddenly see that there is a significant change in the mean model and what happened in the game. You can, you know, quantify or threshold that difference and say, okay, this was a crucial moment of the game. This is a highlight that you should look at. You can also construct player ratings based on that. There are some players that will do the average, but they don't produce match winning or game turning performances. This is another way, you know, you can use this idea. So this is something that we were discussing earlier. How can you use this for player ratings? So you can identify clutch players. Conversely, and I have had this discussion with ICC, is you can also look at these passages of play when things go, you know, really different from what was predicted, and maybe we can flag it for the anti-corruption unit to investigate, you know, if everything was okay or somebody deliberately underperformed. So there are many possibilities of, you know, this technique or this tool to, you know, apply it in different scenarios. So now let's look at the numbers. So here we're showing that it has high accuracy. So what I'm showing here is the mean square error of the mean and the medium for MRSC and RSC version of it, a donor pool averaging version of it. In every case, if you're predicting 5 overs out, the mean square error is 5 times better than RSC. Same thing with median. 10 overs out, it's outperforming. 15 overs out. So even for 20 overs out, it performs better than RSC for 5 overs out. So that additional context actually adds a lot to the system.
Why is the RSC, I mean, the right hand error is almost the same regardless of how far ahead in the future you're predicting, whereas your errors sort of slowly build up?
So this needs actually more investigation. Why it depends on how much pre-intervention data that we have, but I'll get back to you why this is happening. What's a good explanation? But the other question that you asked and I said I'll come back to it, which is the Stein's paradox. Stein's paradox is a well-known paradox in statistics, and in 76 there was a study where it was shown for baseball sort of very effectively this idea of Stein's paradox. And Stein's paradox roughly says that when you're trying to estimate some quantity, let's say you're estimating a bunch of quantities and they are related somehow, then estimating one quantity based on only measurements of that quantity will work worse than a joint estimation of all the quantities. So what Stein's paradox for baseball showed that they looked at some 18 hitters in 1976, and they said that to predict the performance of one player, the prediction actually improved when you consider the performance of other players who were not in the same team, who were not facing the same pitches. They were sort of completely unrelated to that one, but they were able to impact the prediction accuracy of one player's performance. So we did the same thing to test Stein's paradox for cricket. And what we did, we looked at the predictions for the teams England, Pakistan, India and Australia. That's this bottom one. Let me go through this example and then we'll come back to your question. So what we did was we did this whole business of prediction 5, 10, 15, 20 overs out. In one case, the donor pool was restricted to only games England had played. So our intuition would be, you know, to get a better model, just look at England, how they have played, and that will give you a much more accurate, much more closer model. But instead, when we considered all innings, our prediction accuracy was much better. And this was true across all, you know, I'm only showing four, but it was true across all. So when you looked at the donor pool of all innings, it worked much better than donor pool of only India innings for India.
Is it just because you have more data, or why is it called paradox?
Because the paradox is that, you know, why is your estimate improving from some unrelated quantity? So that the latent variable model actually, it is a further sort of proof that the latent variable model is true.
Is it just because, I mean, if at 20 overs I have already lost 6 wickets, the style I would play doesn't depend on whether I'm India or Pakistan or West Indies.
Yeah.
Whereas if I have already 200 runs on the board, I'm likely to be hitting out like nobody's business.
Right. So that's what I mean by games have memory. You know, if you are 20 for 6 in a certain innings, it's because the pitch conditions, the weather conditions, the bowling attack. It's not because you're India, although that may be the case some years back, but you know, the memory is built from other games as well. That's what it really means to be a low dimensional system. And Stein's paradox, actually, if you know, one really study stats, you realize it's not a paradox. It's just counterintuitive. But you know, it's been the MLE estimate for one quantity is better when you jointly estimate multiple quantities. It's called a paradox because it seems counterintuitive, but it's not. And here I think that the latent variable model explains why this is happening. So we don't have to, in our model, explicitly say that, okay, this match is being played in Lords, the conditions were overcast, so pick the donor pool because of only games in Lords. The data-driven technique automatically picks the previous matches, which closely match what's happening in this particular game. So I'll show you some other examples. So these are other games where our predictions work really accurately, but the point of it is this other plot where I'm showing the same examples, but I'm also showing the donor games, the donor pool games whose linear combination is approximating the mean trajectory. So if you look at them individually, they look very different, but there's something intrinsic about the latent variables that there is something close of this trajectory to this trajectory, and the linear combination is able to match the mean trajectory well. So these games, while looking very different, the synthetic game that they build is matching the actual game that's happening. So to conclude, you know, synthetic control is a really exciting new technique. I'm very excited about it. To study what ifs or counterfactuals, it can study the impact of policy interventions, it can study the impact of algorithm or mechanism changes. It's a prediction mechanism for a lot of different scenarios, and MRSC is a generalization of the original synthetic control idea. It makes it robust, and it's able to use multiple dimensions of data to come up with a better predictor. I'll stop here and take questions. No, runs and wickets. Only two.
So you don't take into account overcast sky and?
No, nothing. It's all part of, it's in the data.
Identity of key is not one of the team. Identity of the team is not one of the team.
It's actually bad to use the identity of the team. That's the Stein's paradox. So, you know, you can go back and do a historical cricket rating based on this system to identify clutch players or players who are able to produce game turning or match turning performances, and then maybe you can do that, but the possibilities are limitless. So when we did that donor pool restriction, we were not getting as good results when we had the whole history. The idea is that, you know, your regression will be able to pick out. If things have changed significantly after IPL and, you know, the scoring rates have gone up, then, you know, the donor elements that your regression technique would pick up, whether you use lasso or ridge or whatever, will, you know, automatically filter them out. You don't have to go and explicitly remove games from history.
Other questions? Do cookies ever contact you?
So, have you seen that movie Dil Dhadakne Do?
No,
I've not seen. So a few months ago, you know, one uncle had come from India. He looked like a character from that movie. And I was explaining to him, you know, what we are doing. It's a fun application. Within 30 seconds, he was on the phone to his bookie in Singapore. Mukesh Pai, I found this thing. So bookies will be definitely interested in this.
Because it's a publicly available platform.
Oh, that cricket.mit.edu?
I mean, so if currently if there's a game in progress,
yeah.
Can I enter the data and after 5 overs and sort of figure out?
You can build your own system. You know, our paper is public. Our techniques are public. You can build your own system, sure. Yeah.
Okay, I think that's probably more serious.
Yeah.
What type of what is solved?
What type of?
What is solved?
Like in terms of cricket or?
Not in terms of cricket. Like, what type of what if questions can solve?
So, any type of what if questions which involves an objective metric, something measurable. Right, so something measurable where you want to study the impact, and you have lots of different observations. So you know. I mean, there are some. We need some structure in the data. Which, you know, what I was talking about, low rank and all.
Let me help
yeah.
rephrase that question.
Yeah.
Give an example of a what if question which you cannot answer with this technique, whereas, you know, are there other examples apart from cricket which you can answer?
I cannot predict stock market futures. right? This cannot be used to predict those kinds of things. Because there the time series is sort of it's synchronous, and all those things that are happening, you know, it probably won't work there. But here is an example of that Walmart sales data. So here what we can do is we can build a good pre-intervention model which gives us a good confidence that our counterfactual or our prediction is going to be accurate. And then in one store we can try a different sales technique or different advertising or different marketing model for that, and we see that how does that compare to the counterfactual, and then you can observe the effect of those kind of studies. So a lot of you know, there are things called A/B testing. You can do a lot of that using this, but in a synthetic way. Instead of, you know, explicitly doing randomized controlled trials, this is implicit. Amol. Well, so this was the funniest part, so I highlighted that, but there's something odd that was happening. It shouldn't have gone negative, but yeah. The other thing that happens is if you have enough sample points, then the difference between RSC and MRSC becomes less and less. So, you know, the error converges. With RSC, it converges slower, but eventually it does converge. What MRSC allows you to do is to do the intervention really early. So you're answering a question that was asked earlier. What can I not do?
So you cannot.
It's very difficult to do, right? What allows us to study odd even is we have contemporaneous measurements of other cities where that rule was not enforced. So all the, you know, behavioral changes of society, the weather conditions, climate change, what have you, all that became part of those other measurements. So that latent variable model, It's important for that, you know, those other things, that correlation is persistent. But if you want to make a, you know, prediction, then you don't know how those things are going to evolve. But to build this counterfactual, we have these measurements of things that are important for AQI levels that are happening in other cities. Did that
any
answer?
Questions? Well, you can continue interacting with him at chai.
Why? I just said why.